This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, indeed, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, as we are every Friday morning at 9 o'clock on the station. And we're delighted to have us joined by David Smith, Washington correspondent for The Guardian, and formerly that newspaper's Africa correspondent, where I think he visited all 350 countries in Africa. Sometimes it probably felt like that. He was based in Johannesburg, where we got to meet him and get to know him and pay attention to what he was interested in and what he pointed things out to for us. And we keep in touch because David's perfect in explaining America to foreigners, because he's got one foot in and one foot out in the country. I mean, his spouse is American, and so he's got that lens to look through, but he's a British, but he spent a long time in the U.S. now, so he's got a sense for what is and what isn't important. And we're going to talk about, there's two sets of things, really, American domestic issues or calamities and the foreign circumstances. Let's do the U.S. part first, because it's more complicated, and we try to get a little bit more clarity on this. There's the turmoil in the House of Representatives. There's a battle for who's going to be the Speaker of the House. And I like to remind people that person becomes third in line for the presidency should a calamity occur that kills both president and vice president. And then there's the fate of the budget and aid to various countries and border control issues. And the House of Representatives is frozen into immobility or inability to act. David, with that cheerful introduction, tell us what's going on. Go ahead. Explain it all.
Great to be back. And yes, Washington is in something of a paralysis. Chaos reigns on Capitol Hill. Remember, although Joe Biden, a Democrat, is the president, Republicans do hold a narrow majority in the House of Representatives, while Democrats still control the Senate. And the House has ground to a standstill because there is no speaker, the person who runs the show and he is the third most powerful elected official in America after the president and vice president. If you turn the clock back to January, Kevin McCarthy was elected speaker, but it took 15 rounds of voting with that very narrow Republican majority. And he made some big concessions to the far right of the party, and people predicted then he would not last very long. You know, the far right would push him one way or another and extract their demands. And sure enough, when it came to trying to keep the government running, trying to pass a budget, McCarthy made some compromises for a short-term deal that satisfied Democrats. And he was duly ousted by his own party. And again, he made a concession that was fairly easy to do now. You only needed one member to move a motion to vacate. And that was a couple of weeks ago. McCarthy was gone. First ever speaker to be ousted. An unwanted bit of history for him. And ever since then, Republicans have been struggling to find a replacement. They had an internal vote and went for Steve Scalise, the House Majority Leader. But he quickly worked out that he would not have quite enough support to actually win the speakership itself. Because remember, every Democrat is going to vote against him. So he needs almost every Republican. You know, he could only lose about four Republican votes. So Scalise was here today, gone tomorrow. And the man he beat, Jim Jordan, stepped forward. He was nominated by Republicans last week. And then this week, it has gone to a floor vote. I've been present at both of them yesterday and today. And Jim Jordan has also failed. He was 21 votes short. Republican rebels are refusing to back him. And in the chamber today, it did have a sense of descending into farce as some of those Republicans shouted names such as John Boehner, the former House Speaker, who's not there anymore, or Lee Zeldin, who's also not there anymore. The reporter sitting next to me suggested, you know, is one of them going to nominate Mickey Mouse? It didn't quite come to that, but Jordan's hopes were dashed. And we have stalemate again, cannot stitch together enough Republicans to win the speakership and no one quite knows what's going to happen next, but it just does mean that Congress is failing to function at a time of global crisis in Ukraine and Israel, and with another government shutdown looming domestically.
I'm old enough to remember when the Democrats were the party that had constant internal battles over everything, because there were such widely disparate views about so many issues of consequence. And the Republicans were pretty much a lockstep party. The memorandum would go out and everybody would nod their head sagely and say, yes, of course. And now it seems it has become clearly the opposite. The Democrats, partly I think a function of the way Nancy Pelosi ran the House of Representatives for all those years that she was the Speaker, and now her successor, Hakeem Jeffries, seems to have inherited, at least in part, her gift for bringing them together, even if there are disagreements, whereas among the Republicans, it's like, hold still while we kill your children.
I think that's a great point. I also was schooled in this concept that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall into line. The implication being that Democrats are moved by emotion sometimes and can be fairly chaotic and ill-disciplined and can, you know, break down into factions, whereas Republicans are the ones who are iron-willed and disciplined and a very efficient machine when it comes to preserving power, and analogous in that sense to the Conservative Party in the UK, who are also supposedly the ruthless and disciplined ones. And so, you know, you'd often see the headline, Democrats in disarray, which is appealing to any editor because it has some alliteration to it.
And it was easy to set and type because it was, you know, you just pull it up from before.
Precisely. You're absolutely right. We've seen a dramatic role reversal this year. That was the case in January when Republicans took 15 rounds of voting to support Kevin McCarthy. And there were scenes on the House floor of members almost coming to blows, whereas Democrats were strikingly united. And each and every one of those 15 votes, they all Democrats backed Hakeem Jeffries. And now that's repeating itself in the last few days where, you know, if you sit in that House chamber and watch it, the Republicans to your left as you're sitting there, there's discontent, there's unhappiness, there's not much enthusiasm for their nominated speaker, and you hear these different names being shouted out. And then on the Democratic side, to your right, there's more enthusiasm and gusto, and they shout Hakeem Jeffries' name and they stand and applaud him. They're genuinely united around him. And, you know, you can see so-called Democratic moderates and centrists there. And you can also see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Cori Bush and other members of the left-wing squad. But they're all unified in supporting Jeffries. I think, as you say, part of that is the way Nancy Pelosi ran the ship for years. And, you know, her majority was sometimes just as narrow as the Republican one is now. But it's also a function of how there is not both sides to this argument. Yes, Democrats have their debates. Yes, the party has arguably moved a bit to the left and it has, you know, the squad and so on. But something very different has happened on the Republican side. It's, you know, I felt today like I was watching culmination of, you know, 8 years of Trumpian chaos descending into farce. That party has veered extremely to the right. It has some members, including Jim Jordan himself, who no longer seem to believe in democracy. You know, he was arguably a co-plotter with Donald Trump of the January 6th insurrection. And now some of those chickens are coming home to roost. You know, there are some in the Republican Party whose sole mission appears to be to actually stop Congress working and make a name for themselves on TV and get social media clips that go viral.
One phrase I've heard used is performative politics rather than politics, which is the, you know, the old definition, the art of the possible. You negotiate, you compromise, you reach a conclusion, a consensus, and either something gets done or something else gets done. And this now seems to be permanent audition for a commentary slot on Fox News. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with David Smith from The Guardian. And we're going to pick up where we left off. This is Brooke Spector and we'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're pleased to have our guest today, David Smith of The Guardian, based in Washington, where he helps explain American politics and life to bemused and confused foreigners everywhere. You mentioned the name Donald Trump. I was waiting for that to happen, and you finally did. And now we have to talk about him a little bit. I'm beginning to lose count of the number of criminal or legal proceedings to which he is a party. I note the Washington Post now has a weekly Trump criminal update newsletter, which is interesting to read that every week. But he continues to move onward campaigning by way of the criminal proceedings. It's extraordinary. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I guess nobody else has either. But there are other candidates as well, some of whom appear to be sinking out of sight or running out of money, and at least one or two who may conceivably challenge him as things move forward. And then there are also third party candidates out there lurking in the twilight. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Cornel West, and maybe even Senator Joe Manchin. Take a stab at explaining all of this to us.
Well, all these things are linked because Jim Jordan, struggling to become House Speaker, was endorsed by Donald Trump. So if he wins, I think that will be yet more evidence of, you know, Trump's takeover of the Republican Party and even parts of America. And former Congresswoman Liz Cheney has warned that, you know, if Jim Jordan is Speaker, then you can have no faith at all in the Republican Party. Defending democracy, it will have embraced Trump completely. But yes, to answer your question, meanwhile, Trump has been in court again this week, this time in a civil fraud trial, the allegation that he inflated and falsely exaggerated the value of his properties and assets in order to get favorable terms on loans and deals and so on. I think the fact that he has voluntarily chosen to appear in that New York courtroom and then to stand in the corridor outside holding court, you know, denouncing, holding court, if you'll excuse the pun, denouncing judges and lawyers and the whole process. It's yet again Trump the showman, yet again realizing that this is a way to make himself the center of attention. And as we have written about in The Guardian, it's the moment really when all his legal troubles really merge with his presidential election campaign into one. I mean, they're pretty indistinguishable now. Court appearance is a campaign rally, is a court appearance, is a campaign rally. And it's a preview of coming attractions next year when he faces potentially multiple trials and may literally, you know, walk out of a courtroom, go to a campaign rally and then come back again. It's a measure of just what an extraordinary moment this is in American politics. 10 or 20 years ago, the assumption was if you had even a whiff of a criminal charge against you, you were finished, you know, career-wise. You would certainly try to bury that news. You would try to run away from it and you know, hope voters forgot. Trump, as always, does the exact opposite. He actually talks about these things at his campaign rallies. He uses them as political weapons to further his argument that he is a victim, he is a martyr of the deep state, that these dark forces are out to get him. And he always makes the argument, you know, they're actually out to get you. I'm just the one standing in the way. And his supporters seem to buy that. And I would say not only the Trump hardcore supporters that I talk to, but other Republicans, even those who support other candidates, when I ask them about these legal cases against Trump, they always say, yes, we think they're politically motivated. It's just an attempt to stop Trump. We don't think there's much in it. And so you hear Trump, you know, boasting at his rallies, you know, I'm the only person who, when I get indicted, I go up in the polls. And, you know, he'll joke, you know, if I get one more indictment, then I've clinched the nomination. It's a very bizarre, upside down, inside out world. And I think back to a Trump supporter I interviewed in Iowa a couple of weeks ago who very deadpan with a straight face said, Donald Trump has great respect for the rule of law, which I think is a claim many would find questionable. So all of that means that these these 91 criminal charges against him in four jurisdictions have actually strengthened him, boosted him in the Republican presidential primary. He's got a bigger lead now over Florida Governor Ron DeSantis than he did months ago. And I think Republican donors who hope to stop Trump are disappointed with DeSantis's performance. You do have Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, picking up a bit of momentum. She's had two good debates, climbing a bit in the polls, but I mean, to keep in perspective, still far behind Trump. I don't think he's quaking at the prospect of a Haley candidacy charge yet. And then other candidates, all sort of struggling in the single digit, percentages, not getting very far. So as things stand, most people assume Trump will indeed be the Republican nominee despite or because of these court cases. But as you say, it's also a bit of a melee, a complicated picture next year. Robert Kennedy Jr., who was running the Democratic primary, has dropped out of that and is now running as an independent candidate. He's the son, of course, of Robert Kennedy, former attorney general, is the nephew of President John F. Kennedy, and a vaccine conspiracy theorist.
Among other conspiracies.
Indeed. So we'll see how that goes. And, some people think actually he's more likely to take votes away from Trump than he is from Biden. He certainly appeals to some on the conspiratorial far right. But then you also have Cornel West, a left-wing academic, who says he's going to run in the national race. You have a group called No Labels, who argue the two major parties have been dominant for so long. They deserve a challenger. Again, there are critiques of them. So it may not be just purely Biden versus Trump. There may be all these X factors who might take votes from one or the other. And that really could be crucial because, this election, like others, will probably come down to a handful of swing states where, we've seen in 2016 and 2020, small margins, just a few thousand votes either way can make the difference. And if some of those votes go to Robert Kennedy Jr. or No Labels, it could be really decisive.
I'm always fascinated by the idea of the No Label Party. This is the perfect nihilist approach. We're not even going to tell you who our candidate is. We're just going to say none of the above. Nobody. If you were going to write a successor novel to Being There, this is the one. This is the moment. We're going to take another short ad break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with David Smith from Washington. He's the Washington correspondent, obviously, from The Guardian. And he helps interpret America to a bemused and bewildered pop readership in Britain and in many other places. And we'll be right back after this.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is Brooke Spector, and we're giving you The Deep Dive into American politics this time with David Smith from The Guardian. He lives in Washington, focuses on America, but not just the internecine warfare in the U.S. government. He has to look at the broader picture, too, as befits his role. And what's taking place in Washington is simply one part of a larger international canvas, which includes warfare in the Middle East. It includes the ongoing fighting in Ukraine. Even an election in Poland for a rational party. I think all of these international issues are affected deeply by the chaos in Washington. There are aid packages, quite substantial ones, in the balance for Israel and Ukraine, and even potentially for Taiwan. And then there is the complex issue of increased funds for border control, all of which have domestic implications. Where are we now, David? What is going to happen? Put your prognosticating hat on and tell us.
Yeah, it's a big problem. As Senator Chris Murphy pointed out, this is an all hands on deck moment, with, the world on fire sort of, crises in, Ukraine and Israel and, elsewhere. And it begs the question, is Congress fit for purpose and up to it in the absence of a speaker? So in the very short term, as you say, there are funding requests for Ukraine, absolutely vital to maintain Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia heading into winter. If they don't get the money, they will start to run out of weapons and crucial momentum could be lost. Russia might make big gains there. Funding requests also obviously for Israel and, you know, America's closest ally in the Middle East. That's very urgent and pressing for all sorts of obvious reasons. Yes, border security, other concerns and, you know, not inconsiderable matter of the US government potentially shutting down next month if, Congress doesn't get its act together. So there are, you know, immediate global ramifications of this, but also a deeper philosophical point, which is, you know, at moments like this, many in the world look to the US for leadership. It has a slightly bruised but still intact reputation. It could be argued as a beacon of democracy, a bastion of freedom, certainly the world's most powerful military. And what's going on in Congress now sends a signal that maybe America is not so strong and efficient, and it can't do the job. You know, this at a moment when Biden has staked a lot of his presidency on the argument that democracies can still live for their people and that they're superior to autocracies such as China. But here we are at a critical moment when there is not even an actual U.S. ambassador to Israel at this critical juncture. And I think that will be resolved in the next few days. But, you know, there are other gaps in crucial diplomatic positions in the Middle East. And just an indication that the sand in the gears that after years of dark money, flaws in the Electoral College, the Senate not being representative, rules such as the filibuster, the influence of Donald Trump, so on and so on. American democracy has a decay, is somewhat breaking down and not running as it should be.
In the last few days, China has had its annual, or I think annual, maybe biannual, Belt and Road Initiative conference. They hosted Vladimir Putin on one of his very rare foreign visits to anywhere. Both of them have seemingly embraced North Korea, that stalwart ally in Northeast Asia. And North Korea is, hold on to your hats, folks, busy supplying weapons to Russia to wage its war against Ukraine. And China is obviously positioning itself as the next version of things. That old Western idea of rule of law and international rules of commerce. Now put that in the waste bin. We have a new version of things, and China is your predominant figure. Do people in Washington grasp the impact and import of all this?
I think many of them do. Certainly before the Ukraine and Israel crises erupted, you heard a lot of talk about, China is America's number one threat now. You know, Islamic terrorism, the post 9/11 era, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on, sort of fading more to the background, and now it's all about China. And indeed, some fairly high profile congressional hearings were organized. I think they tried to do them in prime time, hoping to get TV coverage, and that didn't quite work out. And they were sort of fairly bombastic and sort of menacing in a way. But generally, Democrats and Republicans alike talked about and still talk about China as the number one foreign policy issue. Certainly, Biden has been taking steps, and again, even recently, to curtail China's technological power in terms of, you know, what semiconductors and things like that can be transferred to China, you know, various other measures taken. I suspect when the dust settles on these other conflicts, China will sort of loom back into focus. And if someone from the White House was here now, they would, I'm sure, very adamantly say, you know, we have not taken our eye off this ball. We can't be distracted by these other issues. Even so, you know, if you were President Xi in Beijing right now, and of course it's a big if, but, you know, if your plan, your intention is to invade Taiwan at some point, which you hear a lot of speculation in Washington. Will that day come? You might fancy your chances right now with Congress in disarray, with America distracted by both Ukraine and Israel. I think it's still extremely unlikely, but yeah, I wonder if China is watching that, and yeah, the way you outline it there, you know, one does have to worry about these groupings, these rival power centers with, you know, the old West, America, UK, Europe, and so on the one hand, but then a rival bloc developing of China, Russia, North Korea, and others, and whether some of them might seek to exploit or even inflame the Middle East crisis.
Joe Biden took a visit to Israel the other day. It was supposed to be a more all-encompassing visit. There was part two in Amman, Jordan, with the Egyptian president, King of Jordan, and Mahmoud Abbas from the Palestinian Authority. They got rudely canceled by an explosion, a bomb, a misguided missile, an attack, you know, depending on where you sit on the political fence, I guess, of a hospital in Gaza. And that caused ructions in every Arab capital there is practically. And the Biden trip then boiled down to 24 hours in Israel and thank you and goodbye. But there were two outcomes. One, the humanitarian relief corridor is taking shape. And the reiteration that humanitarian issues matter for the U.S. vis-a-vis Gaza. And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. And our guest is David Smith from The Guardian, a Washington correspondent. And we'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and we're speaking with David Smith, Guardian correspondent in Washington, longtime veteran of Africa, where we met him years ago. And I had left him hanging with the question of the effect of the Biden trip. There were some good outcomes, it appears, even if the trip was truncated unexpectedly. And the sound you hear overhead, of course, is an airplane changing its direction. Take the Biden trip to Israel into perspective for us.
Well, Joe Biden's handling of this war in Gaza has been very interesting to watch. He is, of course, said to be an expert in foreign policy. He did it for decades in the Senate. It's one of his real political strengths, he would argue. As 80, he's actually older than the state of Israel himself, and I think comes at it from a traditional left-wing view that was very positive about the creation of Israel. And he's made it clear this is emotional and personal for him. And I went to see him give a speech last week at the White House that was full of passion and very staunch in its support of Israel. And some people described it as the most pro-Israel speech by an American president ever. And at that point, all the rhetoric was about the horror of this Hamas attack and the need to support Israel. And as the week wore on, you saw a gradual evolution of Biden and his allies talking about humanitarian concerns in Gaza and reiterating this point that Hamas does not represent most people in Gaza, and there's millions of innocents there who must be protected. And I think, you know, he set off for Israel, where in public it was all about steadfast support for Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli people. You hear these phrases like ironclad and, all in with Israel, backing Israel all the way. I would think that part of the strategic logic there on the part of Biden and his officials is that by being so pro-Israel in their public comments, it earns them some credit, gives them some leverage to say some other things behind the scenes in private with Israel, where Biden spoke to Netanyahu and the war cabinet, and part of that is, you know, what is your strategy in the mid and long term in Gaza? And part of it, one hopes, one thinks, is cajoling for humanitarian concerns and making at least some sort of breakthrough there in terms of allowing some aid in, you know, urging restraint. And Biden said a bit of that in public. He drew the comparison, as others have, with the September the 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, where he, you know, he and others have said, of course, America felt rage, but don't let the rage consume you. America sought justice, but America also made mistakes. And, you know, when one thinks of CIA torture and the Iraq war and so on, and certainly you've heard a lot of commentary in Washington saying, after this Hamas attack, Israel has huge amounts of goodwill and solidarity around the world. Don't squander it in the way that America did after 9/11 by overreacting and overreaching and, you know, going too far in the response in Gaza. And I think certainly already clearly many people in the Middle East and, some people on the left in America feel that, that is happening. And Biden, I think was trying to prevent that. And, you know, even Republicans have credited him for showing up, for showing foreign policy leadership by actually going there rather than not. I think, he will also have been trying to send a signal to Iran to not, wade into this war by, backing Hezbollah in attacks from southern Lebanon. We'll see what, happens there. But I think, certainly, domestically, Biden has, you know, tampered down criticism from Republicans by showing leadership on this and saying the right things as American presidents do about their support for Israel.
He should get some credit, for pushing through the idea of opening a humanitarian relief, passageway for convoys. I mean, that was in the works, but it was in the works rather than in the being, and his presence there may well have been the deciding weight on that side of the scale. I also went and looked, and as far as I can tell, he's the first American president who visited an actual war zone, a battle site, battle zone, in which the United States is not involved as a combatant country. And that is, that's a precedent that is interesting, because it was entirely possible that there could have been, I don't know, missiles raining down on the airport, whatever, something truly dreadful could have happened. And he took it upon himself to go anyway. So he should get a couple of points just for the courage of it. Even if others will criticize that as being too engaged, too involved, too enmeshed in it personally.
Yes, and the trip was certainly complicated by that explosion at the hospital in Gaza City, where debate still rages over who is responsible. Biden's own team, National Security Council and Pentagon, have at least tentatively concluded Israel was not responsible, but the perception in many Middle East capitals is that surely they did have a hand in it, rather than it being another Palestinian group. And as you say, that led to the cancellation in Jordan. But more broadly, what's interesting is Joe Biden has now been, of course, to a total of two war zones. Several months ago, he also went to Ukraine, which the U.S. is involved with, at least supplying weapons and other logistical support. And of course, this is a man who is now 80 years old and about to be 81. And Republicans are certainly trying to push a narrative that he is too old for the job. This is quite a good comeback to that, to be able to say, actually, I've been to two war zones. How many has Donald Trump been to? And, yeah, you saw Democrats release a campaign ad highlighting Biden's visit to Kyiv, walking with Zelensky, and you know, sirens going off. Maybe we'll now get another campaign ad showing him in Israel So yeah, he's also the oldest American president in history to be making these, trips, maybe not quite evocative of, Henry V wandering the battlefield the night before Agincourt, but, it's a good, riposte, and, you know, there's a deeper point there about, how his age and experience, which, you know, so often seen as a weakness and Achilles heel in this upcoming election, at moments like this, arguably is the opposite, is a real strength that he's been there, seen it before, done it all. You know, he's known Benjamin Netanyahu for decades. I mean, actually a pretty rocky relationship up until this moment, but, he was the right man to bring the West together in Ukraine, and he's the right man to handle this now. And with the Democrats' argument, there's no substitute for that kind of foreign policy experience.
Yeah, you can. I'm glad you mentioned that. You can see the next Biden campaign ad. He's stepping off an airplane, and there are sirens going off, as you say, and then in Kiev, walking through that plaza, even though there are air raid sirens going off, and the contrast to Donald Trump culminating in a court. Over and over and over again, losing track of which court case he's involved in on that moment. That's going to be an interesting evolution that I look forward to. That. We're going to take a very quick ad break and then we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector and we're speaking with David Smith, correspondent from The Guardian in Washington. And when we come back, we want to talk about films for just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. I'm your host, and our guest is David Smith of The Guardian newspaper in Washington. We've been talking about all kinds of international issues and the chaos in American government and the arrival of Joe Biden as a warrior. Somewhat unexpected, I think, for some people. I want to shift gears slightly because I know David is a film buff, even perhaps more than I am. And he and I, it's a trade secret, but every time either of us spots a reference in any way to any of the lines in the film Casablanca in any public utterance by any official anywhere or in any article, it's quick, send a message to it, let him know. But there are two notes about film. One is the death of Burt Young, the actor, most famous perhaps for Sylvester Stallone's sidekick in the Rocky films, and the 50th anniversary of The Exorcist. Gosh, I hadn't thought about that as being half a century old until just recently. I mean, somehow you think of it as just having happened. But here we are, 50 years later, changed the way we think about horror films, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, sad to see Burt Young go. You know, he was in hundreds of films and TV shows and died at the age of 83. As you say, probably best known for the Rocky series, playing Paulie Panino, an alcoholic butcher and friend to Sylvester Stallone's character. And he was in so many of those Rocky sequels. It's that's been an interesting evolution. I mean, when you look back now at the first Rocky, I'm still scandalized and horrified that it beat, I think, All the President's Men to the Best Picture Oscar.
And Annie Hall. Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. and I've been to Philadelphia, seen the statue of Sylvester Stallone as Rocky, which used to have pride of place outside the art gallery. And then people thought that's going a bit too far. It's not quite high art in that way. So it was kind of moved down to street level. Those movies, when you look back, they're interesting in terms of, you know, the Philadelphia white working class. There's an uncomfortable scene where Rocky is basically sexually harassing the woman who's going to become his wife. But seeing through the prism of the Donald Trump era, you know, what does it say about white America and that notion of the American dream? And then the evolution of Rocky, where of course it spawned the Creed series, and you know, Rocky becomes the trainer of Apollo Creed's son. and there's been three of those Creed films now. He's African American. So, and then, you know, other strange things happen, like the Russian boxer, his son turns up. It's quite a saga. And, on one level, it's pure entertainment. On another, you're seeing something about American racial politics and the evolution there. And Burt Young was a great character actor and part of it. As for The Exorcist, 50th anniversary of its release in December. By coincidence, I actually went to see it at the cinema again a couple of weeks ago. There's a re-release marking that anniversary. And it was quite effective because I was almost the only person in the entire auditorium. Two or three others came in, but that added to the spookiness of it, sitting alone in a dark cinema. A beautiful, beautifully remastered version of it. The colors were very vivid, and it actually stands the test of time quite well. I was reminded there are some very good actors in it. Now, it particularly strikes a chord with me these days because it's a film set in Washington, D.C., and so I sat there sort of looking at places I know and recognize. A lot of it's at Georgetown University, beautiful Gaston Hall there, you know, wonderful Victorian style architecture. Again, by further coincidence, I had been on that very spot in that very hall, you know, just the previous day. And then I was there again the following day for, you know, events with Mike Pence and Hillary Clinton. Some would say that's their own version of a horror story. But the Exorcist, sort of revels in those locations. And I'm sure we will see a lot of pilgrims going to the Exorcist steps in Georgetown. For people who don't know the movie, that plays a crucial part in the plot. These very high steps leading up to the streets of Georgetown. They took some poetic license. So in the house is actually much closer to the steps in the film than in real life. I learned from a sort of special little film documentary that they showed, the house interiors were actually a set in New York. But the build-up is quite good and atmospheric. And of course, what everyone remembers is a young girl played by Linda Blair, you know, possessed by the devil, head spinning around, vomiting, coming out with all this crazy sort of swearing, you know, the C word and you name it. On one level now it's a little bit sort of quaint and farcical. On another level it's actually quite still chilling and effective, and you know, you're aware of its importance in movie history, sort of inspiring so many other horror movies, including a string of absolutely terrible Exorcist sequels. And there's actually yet another new Exorcist movie coming out now, or just come out, with Ellen Burstyn returning at the age of about 90. Another veteran like Burt Young. So I'm sure I'll be writing an article about The Exorcist and Washington and you know, 50th birthday.
Yeah, there are people who probably want to argue that Congress needs an exorcism pretty soon.
Actually, I went to a congressional dinner earlier this year at what used to be the Trump International Hotel. And it's now changed to the Waldorf Astoria. And Senator Raphael Warnock, who is a pastor and preacher, gave the speech. And he said, you know, I'm now going to offer a prayer, but given that this used to be the Trump Hotel, perhaps it should be an exorcism. And yeah, many people feel like that about the White House and much else in Washington after Trump's departure.
Full disclosure moment. I was born in Philadelphia, and I remember those art museum steps before the Rocky statue, before it was up and before it was down. It is and remains one of the great scenic vistas in an urban landscape, both from the bottom looking up to that neoclassic facade and from the top looking out over the city as a whole. I don't know how many millions of children have tried to run up those steps as a result of those films. David, it's been a delight to have you on air again. We'll do this again when there are more things piling up that require your explanation and clarification. We've been speaking with David Smith, the Washington correspondent of the Guardian newspaper, and this is your host, Brooke Spector. This is The Deep Dive, and we will be back again next week with yet another interesting, thoughtful, illuminating, entertaining, hopefully even guest to explain some facet of this country, the world, and the lives we live. Again, David, thanks very much for joining. Now you get to go back to sleep.